I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate today, and this is New York Public Radio, WNYC and WNYC.org. It's estimated that between 10 and 20 million people from the African continent were sold into slavery from the year 1500 until 1850. For people across the African diaspora, the tragedy of slavery has left many difficult questions about their family histories. In her new book, author and Columbia University professor Sadia Hartman recounts the journey she took along the Atlantic slave trade route in search of answers about what really happened to these people and about her own heritage. The book is called Lose Your Mother, and it is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the show today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How did you begin this journey? What was it that set you on it?
This journey was long in the making. My great-grandfather took my brother and I on a trip when I was about 12 years old to the rural outskirts of Montgomery County to tell us our family history. And that was the first time I had a deep personal awareness of my family's enslavement. It was a kind of an abstract fact before then, and that just sparked my interest and obsession with these enslaved ancestors who we just had bits and fragments of information about. And my great-grandfather planted this seed that I thought was dormant until I started doing research in graduate school, and I began to be involved again in questions about slavery and its legacy, slavery and memory.
What an extraordinary experience to go with your great-grandfather, who I would assume was probably fairly old at that point, but who was so much closer to those ancestors who had been enslaved.
It was a tremendous experience, and I remember we called him Papa, driving us around in his brown Ford and sticking his finger out of the window and saying, well, you know, this is where this happened. And basically, he just told us a story of when his mother found out that she was free, about a Union soldier approaching her and telling her that she was free. And I always idolized my great-grandfather. He was like Hercules to me. So to see just all the emotion on his face, both the kind of the sadness and the grief, really left an impression on me. And it made me want to understand the connection between that historical experience and who I was in a much more intimate sense.
And amazing that you were one generation in your great-grandfather away from slavery, that it was his mother who had been freed.
Yes.
What is that story of the Union soldier? Can you tell us what you know of it?
Well, my great-grandfather was talking, I mean, my great-grandfather was from a rural background, and we were actually driving through this landscape that was mostly owned now by large agribusiness. So there was a doubled sadness in a way, the sadness of all this land that he in his lifetime knew the farmers who owned it, and many of those farmers had been black farmers. And it was the connection between that loss of land and the experience of slavery that was so precious for him. And basically the story he told me was really not more than three sentences about a Union soldier approaching my great-great-grandmother, telling her that she was free, and her running up to her mother and telling her the news and just her name, Ellen. And that started my own quest. For years I wrote, you know, lots of bad poetry about her. But it connected with my research when I was a graduate student, and I had this experience of coming across another great-great-grandmother in the WPA narratives, and again, feeling that very personal, an experience of being arrested. Like, attend to this not only as a scholar, but this is part of your makeup, these bits and pieces of stories.
It's part of who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that have kind of left this mystery that I'm still living.
So you took that seed, which was planted so early, and started on quite a journey to explore what had led up to this foremother, Ellen, in Montgomery County.
And I think I was surprised on that journey. I mean, I made a journey across the Atlantic. And I think for many people, the journey across the Atlantic is the journey of kind of suturing, you know, the divide. And for me, the journey across the Atlantic was more an announcement of the separation than a way of suturing the divide. And what I discovered on that journey, and I guess I didn't imagine that I started out on that journey in any naive fashion, but in fact I was naive, and I was surprised at the matter-of-fact attitude of many Africans towards slavery and towards the transatlantic slave trade, and then to just discover the really different ways that different African communities, classes of Africans were affected by the slave trade as well.
Now, you talk about that first journey, the one across the ocean, as a kind of opening up. What did it feel like when you finally landed on African soil? I mean, it's interesting to hear about your family's connection to the soil here, to then go to the soil of Africa.
And I think that I began my journey with a certain degree of disenchantment, maybe too strong a word, but I knew I wasn't Alex Haley. I knew I wasn't going back to reclaim the motherland. So it was a combination of wonder and distance. Like, okay, what am I going to find here? But understanding that, no, I'm not African. I mean, an experience in the Americas has created me. So I wasn't, you know, dancing with joy when I arrived at the airport, but I was waiting to have some part of my identity answered.
Did you find that?
I think I did. At the end of my trip, it was a different answer than I expected. And that answer actually brought me back across the Atlantic again. And by that, I mean my journey in Ghana was along a slave route that extended from the coast to the hinterland. And there's a small town, Gwelu, that's on the border of Ghana and Burkina Faso, and it's a fortified town. In the era of the slave trade, many communities under siege to build these walls and other fortifications to repel slave raiders. So in Gwelu, I met people who also had a history of having their lives shaped, threatened by this encounter with slave raiders. But what was interesting for me about the people in Gwelu was they were people who had come from other parts of the hinterland and the forest, and basically they had to remake their identities in order to create a free community. So in Gwelu, the story that they told there was one about becoming together, becoming anew. So it was much more the story of fugitives and exodusters and maroons than I was expecting. And it was in that journey and in that search and in that self-fashioning that I found this chord with my own history that was really powerful. And I guess as well the possibilities that unfold in the aftermath of loss.
And that you found within that community a dislocation, which was echoed in the dislocation of people being forcibly taken to this country.
Right. I hadn't imagine that there were internal diasporas in Africa as well, so that they too were forced to undergo this trek. I mean, even though they weren't enslaved and they were able to resist enslavement, the journey that enabled them to resist that and the kind of solidarity that they had to forge with others led them to recreate their identity, to remake who they had been. And in that sense, it very much echoed my own story. And it held up a mirror not only of tragedy, but of possibility, the poetics that are part of the experience of dispossession, the names that are forced upon us and the names that we also choose.
That's hearing about your great-great-grandmother, Ellen, and thinking about what her great-great-grandmother's name might have been.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because in the course of doing research for the book, I mean, I spoke with grand aunts about, you know, what they knew about my great-great-grandmother. And basically no one could remember. Ellen was the name that people remembered. No one remembered Ella. And when I looked at the census records, the names were actually different. They were
really?
Yes, there was an Adeline and an Adela. And I had this choice of, you know, what were going to be the names that I would then put down in the book? Were they going to be the names that my great-grandfather told me, or the names that were reported, you know, more officially or perhaps even incorrectly on a census? But even at that that level of the writing process, I was experiencing the gap between the archive and the written record and how we live the experience of our past.
And names can be so powerful. I know in many cultures there is the outside name and the inside name. There's the name that you can have with the people who love you, and there's the name that you give to people who are taking down your name for some particular reason.
And certainly that was an issue given the kind of hierarchies of power caused by racism in the South with, you know, white interviewers and census takers, that people were very cautious about what it was that they shared and often withheld things that made them vulnerable. So yeah, there's a lot of power in naming, and there's also the disguise that's a part of naming.
I'm speaking with Sadia Hartman, who is the author of Lose Your Mother. Now, Sadia, where did that name, that title come from, Lose Your Mother?
Lose Your Mother is the way that people talk about the enslaved in West Africa. They'll often say that those who were enslaved lost their mother, they lost their country, they lost their kin. When we think about the most, you know, capacious definition of who the slave is a stranger. The slave is someone who's cut off from family and kin. So that loss is the primary definition of what it is to be enslaved. So Lose Your Mother both attend to the meaning of enslavement, and for me it also attends to the meaning of being a subject of the diaspora. What it means to be the kind of person who's shaped by loss. Loss has made you, and that loss will always mark who you are in the world. So it describes both the slave and it describes who I am in the world. I'm someone who lost that motherland, whether as myth or reality.
And that experience of loss closes things and opens other things.
It's about the tragedy of having lost a connection, the rupture and the incredible violence and terror that's a part of that loss. And then it engenders new terms of connections. I mean, the last chapter of the book is called The Fugitive's Dreams, and it's about the connections with others that also unfold when you're forced to name yourself anew. And that's the note that I try to end things on, the possibility that's also a part of dislocation, the new terms of solidarity it creates between you and others.
One of the interesting things in the book is looking at the kind of journey that you make and the fact that you're not the only one, that this is now becoming something that many people do, and that the people in Ghana have looked at this and said, what do we do for these people coming from America? What did you find about their relationship to people like you who were coming?
It's really a comedy of errors, because Ghana is a developing, struggling third world country, is trying to cultivate tourism as a source of national development. And in that, they're reaching out to African Americans. But some of the ways that they reach out reveal these really interesting moments of, you know, mistranslation or misunderstanding. So the first organized PanaFest, a Ghanaian concert theater company wanted to welcome African-American visitors by performing a blackface minstrel show, which they imagined was like homage to like American culture. And that performance tradition was actually very influential in Ghana, so it's not surprising that they would do that, but that that would be a way of welcoming African Americans is laughable. Or, you know, when Ghanaians speak of the slave trade, when you're in the castle, there's a panel in the museum, and it addresses the gains and loss of the slave trade. Like, literacy and Christianity versus people missing. And for me, as a descendant of the enslaved, I had never had a tally of gains and loss that were a consequence of that encounter. Ghanaians also see African Americans as, you know, another variant of the rude, brash American making their way through the third world landscape. So I think it's paradoxical because African Americans often experience themselves as the most intensely American they've ever felt in their entire life when they return home to the motherland. So I mean, I think that it's engendered really a number of interesting discussions about the comparative heritage of slavery, the different memories we possess in Africa and in the diaspora, and has encouraged us to begin a process of trying to build a common language as opposed to presuming that that common language already exists.
Because there was a common thread that met many hundreds of years ago, but now today things have gone in so many different directions.
Right, and I also say that my ancestors were the people who even in Africa became strangers, right? So even as they were passing through those towns and villages and coastal cities in Ghana, they were strangers and they had already been marked and separated from their own context. So the distance reverberates not only my distance as an American from a Ghanaian, but the difference between being a descendant of the enslaved versus not being a descendant of the enslaved.
My guest is Sadia Hartman. She has written a book called Lose Your Mother, and we're going to continue our conversation in a moment. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopay today, and right now, Sadia Hartman is here. She is a teacher at Columbia University and has written Lose Your Mother, which is from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And it's about her journey back to Ghana to trace the roots of her own family and of slavery. Sadia, in the town of Salaga, you write about having a chance to meet the chief of the community who is familiar with the region's history and slavery. What did he tell you about the community's former slaves?
Basically, when talking with the chief, he told me that the traces of them had mostly disappeared and that we don't speak of a person's origins. We don't point the finger and say someone is a slave. Even though Salaga had been one of the largest slave markets in West Africa and the prosperity and history of the town was inseparable from slavery.
Did there seemed to be an awareness of the, or was there a willingness to talk about the part that Africans played in the slave trade?
The chief was particularly self-conscious about Salaga's role in the slave trade with me, someone who's a slave baby, someone who's the kind of the product of that experience. And Salaga was involved in the trade not only as a marketplace, but it was a warrior aristocracy, so the soldiers of Salaga created many captives. And the role that the town played, the chief hemmed and hawed a bit about that, even though he was very willing to talk about Salaga's past in relation to tourism. He was willing to talk about a bit of the past that actually didn't have implications for their present. So the issue of slavery and who is of slave descent is a very sensitive issue in Ghana. This is why one doesn't speak of someone's origins. To be a descendant of slaves is actually a source of shame there. That's why the chief would never say, oh, this person was a descendant of slaves. But when it was a matter of tourism, he welcomed visitors, even though the story that he was willing to tell was very edited.
Did the complicated layers that you found surprise you? Had you expected a more straightforward narrative when you arrived there?
I think I did expect a much more straightforward story. I think I was expecting something like the U.S. story, which was, okay, we had these great principles and values, and slavery was in contradiction to all those principles and values, and we did it because it was expedient, but yes, we know it was wrong. And the story wasn't that clear cut. So I realized that I was expecting... I think I was expecting to encounter the political doctrine of liberalism, you know, in Africa, to encounter a political critique of slavery as being wrong. And that's not what I encountered. There were so many different kinds of slavery in Africa. And the kind of slavery, those who were enslaved who wound up in the Atlantic slave trade, those were slaves who were created for the market as opposed to domestic slaves. So slavery is much more complicated an institution there. But I was surprised that there wasn't the readily available critique, and that people were much more reluctant and unwilling to talk about it. But I think that it implicates people there differently. I mean, in the U.S., in some sense, the line not to are black and white, but that if you're basically of African descent, you are of the enslaved. You take on the heroism and the tragedy of what it is to be enslaved. Africans were involved in the trade as victims largely, but also as trade partners. So depending on who you talk to, they have a radically different story to tell.
I think that may be why when Edward P. Jones' book, The Known World, came out, that all of a sudden here in this country we saw there's a complicated story to be told here as well, that things aren't as simple, which makes it much more interesting, much sadder too.
No, I mean, particularly as someone who was working on slavery in Africa, I really loved Edward Jones's The Known World, because so much of the drama of that book is what it means to inhabit the role of slave master, and how the role is actually more determining than even race in that context. And certainly that's the African experience. And again, I think in the U.S., where the language of race is so much the language of solidarity, right? We were all black together to enter a social and political space where there's no presumption of unanimity based upon blackness, right? And it crosses these major social contradictions, right? Master, slave, raider, raided, that I experienced. I enjoy the richness that Jones was able to kind of to convey in The Known World.
And it sounds like you experienced a similar issue going on in Ghana, too, that these questions are much more complicated than you would have expected.
Much more complicated. On the coast, there's a saying, the Dutch boat left Elmina and then we became poor, meaning the slave trade ended and then we became poor. In the north, they say, we don't tell the story of slavery because if we tell it, we weep. Those are two
radically different
statements about slavery.
You talked a few minutes ago about the castle. Talk a little bit about what took place in this particular castle and what is there today.
Basically, the castles were built in the 15th century. Elmina Castle was built in 1482 as a large trade and military fortification. And when the slave trade began, the storerooms of the castle began to fill with captives. And depending on how many captives were in hand, between hundreds to 1,000, and people could, you know, remain in these dark storerooms for a matter of weeks or months. The conditions were horrible, as you would imagine. And I had read so much about the experience of enslavement, and I had done all this research before I arrived, and I entered those spaces myself. I don't even know if if now, even if after having written the book, I can actually describe what it was like the first time to enter one of those storerooms, because it's an empty room. And the emptiness, in a way, it speaks volume. It brings to mind, you know, all the masses of people who are trapped there and their disappearance, but the finality of their disappearance, because there's no register of names, there are no traces of where they came from, there are no lists. It's literally an empty room. And I just thought, how do I begin to tell my history, my story, which is about this encounter with nothing, which is about this encounter with an empty room? So it was staggering, and it just left me without a language to describe it.
Sadia Hartman is my guest. She has written a book called Lose Your Mother, about exactly what you're talking about right now, that experience of... what I find very interesting is there's so many levels to your own experience. You're a scholar, and so you've done all of this research, but you're the great-great-grandchild of a slave whose name you know, so you have that personal connection, too. Did you find, as you wrote the book, that it was challenging to keep all of those different layers together? Because on the one hand, you were analyzing, and on another hand, you were experiencing what was going on.
It was hard to keep all those layers together, and I think emotionally it was painful and it was difficult. And I think I wanted to hide behind my scholarly objectivity. And I remember a Ghanaian colleague saying, no, you have to be a witness here. You're a descendant of these people. So I felt unwilling, even though it was a personal journey I had embarked on. It was also emotionally overwhelming, so I wanted it to protect myself by making it much more scholarly than it had been. But in order to write the book, I had to connect with that well of pain and sorrow. I had to connect with those tears. I had to connect with that longing. And I think that ultimately that in combination with the scholarship is what makes this book different from just about every other book that's on the slave trade.
Well, I think also as a reader, that piece is essential, because that is the piece that allows me as the reader to connect to you as a writer and to your past, is that it's personal. I can imagine that it's much more complicated, because it's easier to take a kind of distanced look at things. But as you were saying about walking into that room, it's much more challenging to be able to convey your own feelings at a particular moment.
Oh, and it was especially the case in one of the chapters of the book where I write about the suicide / murder of a 13-year-old girl aboard a slave ship. And there are only 6 words about her in the legal trial for her murder. One is a said Negro girl, and the other describes her as a sulky bitch. This is what the captain described her as. So to try to recreate a life for this girl aboard the slave ship, I had to really not only open my imagination, but I had to open my heart to try to bring her alive, to resuscitate this forgotten life.
What did you imagine her to be? How did you create her in your own mind?
I started off at first with the body, the description of her physical state, and she had starved herself for a number of weeks. And I read all these studies about the effects of hunger on the psyche and what it causes you to imagine, and the hallucinations you have, and the way you oscillate between these kind of grand feelings and these feelings of depression, and imagining that those physical conditions of kind of, you know, this enhanced sense and this depressed sense being representative of her desire for a way off that ship and its impossibility at the same time. And I thought of, you know, 12 and 13, it's such a liminal age, it's such a liminal period in one's life, and to experience that rupture, to be perched between being a child and to be a woman, and to have the world that you've known just fall away, and
to lose your mother in such a powerful way.
And then to think about her courage in the face of that, and her decision in this context of terror. And I wanted to attend to her and the drama of this short, of this very short last moment of her life, but which is the only moment of her life that we have. And we don't even have her name, right? We just have this description of her, but to attend to her and to have us feel what the loss of her life means even now.
Did you find that in doing, in taking this journey, your own work as a scholar has changed? Have you, what is it that you teach, and how did this affect the work that you do?
Well, I started out on this journey thinking of myself as a writer, but then I went to graduate school, and that, fell behind. I mean, for me, it's been a wonderful experience in that I wrote an academic book about slavery, and I can remember reading parts of that academic book, and actually I read parts of it at a talk that I gave in Ghana, and people said to me, oh, this is so important, but I want to understand it. It's too difficult for me to understand it. And I feel that now I'm at a point where I get to share those stories with a lot more people, and with people who really care about them. So I've gained something in the course of this, and I've kind of gained connection to many more people. And I think as a scholar, I'm more courageous than I have been, because I really have to stand behind my words. I have to put my body behind my words. My identity is connected to this project. So in that sense, it's also been a transformation.
It sounds like it was also a little scary to do this.
It was very scary, and so not at all like who I am as a person, who's kind of like a wallflower who doesn't ever want to be in the center of the spotlight. So to share these very personal moments about myself or my family isn't something that I ever imagined myself doing.
And to imagine those moments for other people of whom we only know six words.
And it's important work. It's the ethical work that we do for the dead. I mean, I always think of Toni Morrison's words about writing Beloved as a way of attending to those who are unceremoniously buried. And I think of my labor in this book as being exactly that, of attending to those who we have failed to attend to.
Well, it's such a pleasure to talk with you, Sadia Hartman. And your new book is called Lose Your Mother, and you're going to be speaking this week, right? You're giving a talk and signing books tomorrow at Hugh Mann Bookstore on Frederick Douglass Boulevard between 124th and 125th Street. On tomorrow's show, we'll look at how politics has hindered the cleanup of raw sewage spilling from Mexico into Southern California. Then Vietnamese-born Biet Minh Nguyen tells of fleeing Saigon to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and the culture shock of Twinkies, Pringles, and Toll House cookies. Plus, an unusual documentary that draws upon literature being created by soldiers in the war in Iraq. And a doctor talks about the positive side of disease. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Scott Goldberg, Paula Crossfield, Barbara Kahn, Stephen Phillips-Horst, and Gabrielle Galanek.